Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, we have another interesting show dealing with a subject that is as wide as you can get, and that is consciousness within the kingdoms of life. And it's going to be consciousness, yes, but it's also going to be dealing with how consciousness grows in life and what is God's plan underneath the entire concept. And to begin with tonight, as I usually do, I will start by defining consciousness. Now, I've defined consciousness pretty much the same way in every show I've ever done talking about it. Tonight I'm going to do the same thing, but by the end of the show, I think that the definition will be a little more complete than it has been up to this time in my teaching. So hopefully that will make sense to you, and if you stay with us, then I think you're going to get a pretty good overview of what consciousness is. A lot of people got confused by this word. They think it's like, well, you're either awake or conscious, or you're asleep or dead. Well, it could be that black and white in some respects. Consciousness is really a very relative term, though. And so it isn't a switch of on and off. Rather, we would claim, or I would claim, it's a development of how choices that we make are connected to additional choices that we either discover other people have made or other things have made, or new choices that we have come to a conclusion of and used our older choices in some way to connect to those. The connection of choices is consciousness. And the planning of looking for new choices is also part of consciousness. And the direction that the creativity comes from within the choices, the way we create from choices, that direction is consciousness as well. Looking at it from another angle, since consciousness is also the both awareness and the ability to understand other people's consciousness and other life's consciousness, then that's also part of consciousness. So love becomes part of consciousness, as well as understanding. All of those factors together are consciousness. So consciousness is not just understanding, it's not just direction, it's not just planning, it's not just love, it's all those and much, much more. Another word that oftentimes is used in defining consciousness is inclusiveness. Well, exclusiveness would mean that you ignore the choices of others. Inclusiveness means that you include and further understand some amount of the choices of others. So you can see inclusiveness and consciousness all part of the same ballgame. And this definition, while seemingly easy, because I just defined it in less than 2 minutes, is not that easy to completely understand, because as our consciousness grows, our understanding of what consciousness is, it relatively increases. So people who might be listening to me who have limited consciousness, and I'm not going to try to define them or who or what, I'm just using this as an example, and if there are any, by the way, the limited consciousness people might be looking for a very denotative, like a dictionary definition of consciousness that had 3 or 4 sentences in it, and that didn't define consciousness in any kind of relative term, but gave it an absolute quantity or an absolute structure in which you could define it strictly by interaction or by action, or sometimes by measurement. All of those things are not possible with consciousness. And although I have for a long time studied consciousness, I have not found any way to do either of those ways of defining consciousness. Now, is it possible that someone somehow will come up with that? Probably not, and I'll explain to you why not. There's a thing called heuristic thought. What is heuristic thought? Heuristic thought says that consciousness is the foundation of all applied knowledge. And all things that we think we understand really comes not from the knowledge, but from the underlying consciousness, we'll say, as a foundation below the knowledge. And that's, I'm probably not doing a lot of justice to heurism, but that gives you a general idea. So there are structures of consciousness of a sort called heurism, but those structures are all relative. They're relative to the ability to understand, to be able to put things together in unique ways. And so a very conscious person, taking our example from a minute ago, instead of a limited consciousness person, might be hearing me and saying, oh, so that applies to these 50, 60, 100,000 areas of my experiences, my life, my thoughts in general, and the thoughts of those that I'm aware of. So they have a unique form of consciousness based upon who they are and how they developed themselves. And so consciousness is related to a thing that also is extremely important, and that is the self and individuality. So basically, everybody that is individual, which means separate from others by usually their own creation, and the creation comes from their own thought, everybody that is an individual, which is almost all people, of course, but it goes to a much wider extent than that, has uniqueness, great uniqueness in consciousness, in every step of creating more of the self, or the conscious part of what we call human, then is developing greater levels of consciousness in the process. This is a unique kind of instrument, then, because it is constantly changing, and it is constantly self-created, which is unusual in itself, because there's very few things that we can look at where we can say, here is something that is self-creation. And the interesting part about this is that it's through consciousness that humans, particularly, find God, because in the basis of being self-created and self-creative, both, the human being becomes aware of what that means, which is that God created life to do this, and God itself wants this for all life, and we are part of that life that can, for the first time, humans for the first time, of all the lower kingdoms of life, can actually recognize. So this all becomes an amazing array, we'll say, of experience that leads a person into the realm of something that is, in terms of physics, now I'm going to switch to a very scientific approach, in terms of physics, has with it the strangeness that happens in what is known as quantum physics. Now, why is it strange and why is it similar to quantum physics? Because the development of what we call a state of mind is dependent upon the thought of both the person and ultimately any thought that is surrounding anything else that's greater than the thought of it. So oddly, in quantum physics, as an example, energy follows thought greater than its own, and once you can think strong enough to affect even subatomic particles, which is not all that hard actually, then the process is such that you're beginning to have a, we'll say, creative effect on all things around you. Therefore, consciousness is not a condition that strictly lies on the individual side. There's another side to it. And that side is that it is balanced with a thing called group consciousness. So we are all becoming individuals, we're all becoming more conscious, but at the same time, we are becoming more other-aware, and then other directed and other concerned and loving towards. And all of that still is consciousness. Some people say, well, that's a conflict because you have two things that are kind of paradoxical. Human beings are becoming more individual. Why, they're becoming more group conscious? Yes, that's exactly right. But for some people with limited understanding, and that's a lot of people, and now this is not a derogatory statement, what happens is their thought process is, well, how can you be an individual if you're always concerned about the other folks in the world? And isn't that crazy thing you say doesn't work called social justice? And I say, well, no. Social justice means that everybody has to have the same consciousness, or that's all they deserve to have. Whereas in the system I'm describing, it's everybody's free to create their consciousness. And each person that is conscious gives the freedom of others to do so or not themselves. That's the difference. That's way different than social justice. That's kind of a capitalistic consciousness experiment, if you want to call it that. And this is true, oddly, in physics. Everybody thinks that physics is controlled by laws that control the state of nature and of matter and energy. In actuality, those laws break down, and when they do, they break down when you get down to single or individual levels of consciousness on very, very small scales where we exist at. That's the only place we can notice it. We could notice it much easier in bigger scale, but we can't. Well, most of us cannot live in those other dimensions of time and space where it's so obvious. So here, we live in a dimensional realm in which it is very difficult for us to see much of anything other than in a subatomic scale. And in that scale, it's pretty clear that what we think of is an absolute realm of rules and laws and particleization and all kinds of other, we'll say, definitenesses of existence, breaks down into a relative and very, we'll say, thoughtful realm in which everything is determined through both consciousness and, we'll call it, choice. And the two together come out to be thought. So you could say that the universe is really controlled by thought. Only those things that have enough thought can control those things with much less. And the control is only based upon the limitations that are applied, not upon control in a way in which it's destructive, other than, of course, evil, which would choose to be destructive, but its consciousness is limited in itself. So it has a limitation on its own destructiveness, even though it seeks that for life. That's a way off the subject. Okay, so let's get back to what we were saying. Consciousness within the kingdoms of life is an amazing story. It is a story that begins with there being no life, no life that can be explained or we're aware of. And it usually begins on planets like Earth. But there are other planets where life can exist. The physical Earth is designed as a planet to be particularly hospitable to physical life and etheric parts or electromagnetic parts of that physical life. It is not attuned very well, as it is in physical form, to the life of astral creatures, astral beings, which is what we become through our own consciousness when we die. Or, putting it a different way, when we live in the physical realm, our physical senses, the sensible ones, the ones that we can perceive readily. Most people think there's five, there's really seven, but regardless, those senses are stimulated or vibrated at a certain phase or direction, let's say, by material or physical things. They are barely sensible to anything that vibrates much quicker or at a different phase. As a matter of fact, the odd thing about the physical dimension is you have the dense physical, which is solid or has a mass to it, and then you have the electromagnetic, which is mostly waves, and the particles we think exist are actually representations of some kinds of waves from another realm. And so it's a lot of wave stuff. Now, what is a wave? A wave is the ability for something to express itself and take action without ever leaving where it started from, but moving as fast as, or even maybe faster, but certainly as fast as up to the speed of light, without any constraint by form or physicalness. A wave, in other words, could be a spring that goes across the room, and every time you vibrate one side of it, the wave goes down the other side, and it travels at a speed relative to the amount of energy that the particular spring has been created or has trained itself to be able to move at a particular time. Now, the interesting thing about the electromagnetic parts of us is that they're not as noticeable. We don't notice the electromagnetic parts. They're more closer to being subconscious for most people than are the purely physical senses. So our physical senses overpower, to a large extent, our electromagnetic or etheric, which is a more metaphysical term, parts. But those parts still can be sensed by most people to some small degree. But then we get to the astral parts of us. And some of you are saying, well, I thought we don't go there till we're dead. And yeah, we still have a body, and we still have senses. The difference is consciousness. Our consciousness is attached to and directly connected to our etheric and physical senses. They are not, while we're physically alive, connected simultaneously to our astral senses, if we're human. Now, you could say, well, if we're human, what if you're not human? What if you're a dog? No, I wasn't talking about that direction of life. If you go greater than the human being, then you can actually sense simultaneously the astral dimension while you're simultaneously living in the etheric physical. That's a huge advantage. Beyond that, members of the next kingdom can also sense in the monastic, the mental dimension. At the same time, they can sense in the astral and the physical, and they usually have those pretty well balanced. So it's like one sense of 21 senses of sorts, and those senses become a single sense. It's a sense of not only understanding God, it's a sense of being God in three dimensions of time and space at the same time, giving you tremendous ability to at least be omniscient, if not omnipotent, eventually. So it's a great thing to have, but we're not there. Human beings have their consciousness focused in one body at a time, and that's what we call living to us. Our life, at least our lifetime, is measured usually per body. So we live here in the physical world. Let's say we live, I don't know, somewhere 70, 80, 90, maybe 100 years. And in that period of time, we become lulled into a kind of wrong impression, unless we've studied some of the things I talk about, or depending upon your own consciousness. But unless that, you would be in illusion to believe that since all you can sense is in this realm, there's a good chance there's nothing else. When you die, you just, goodbye, that's it. So long, Vider Zane and all that other stuff. You would be no longer in existence because your perceptions of things and your conclusions about those perceptions and your consciousness that is behind or underneath all that you have is what you call what you know, tells you there's nothing else. Now, a lot of people say, well, wait a second, I believe there's an afterlife. Yeah, that may be true, but it's a belief rather than a knowledge, and there's a difference. Now, let me explain this. I'm not saying that we all have to be, in some way, knowledge-bearing people. I think faith is fine, but I think to go beyond faith, you need to be conscious of the other realms, which is more than just know, well, I know they exist because I listen to your show, or I know they exist because I can do the math that suggests that the quantum constant changes, like you said, and then you really can see how this all works out. Or you know from 100 other reasons. But the point is that that kind of knowledge without the consciousness or understanding of what the knowledge really is about still doesn't give you the conclusive understanding that when you leave this world, you're going on to the next. Now, experience can also provide some of this, although people will doubt their experiences given enough time. But in any case, most people don't have out-of-body experiences, partly because it's so difficult, and there's a natural fear to change your consciousness from your etheric physical senses to your astral, which is what you have to do in order to leave this dimension and go to the astral plane. The reason there's this natural fear is the sensation is one of dying. Not in any kidding sense, it actually feels like that. And to the personal part of us, the subconscious part, the personality, it goes freaky. So I've trained some people on how to leave their physical bodies, but less than half are successful. And the reason for that is their fear of death is so great that they subconsciously keep stopping the process. And so that's a difficulty that we all have to overcome. And it's a little bit here, a little bit there, and gradually you gain enough confidence in your subconscious that you aren't going to stop the process and you go through with it. And even though you do leave a physical body and you're still completely conscious in this astral world in an astral body, you don't any longer have this, you know, terrible dread, like you're never coming back. Even if you're going to the other side, how do you know the body that you were in, the physical one, won't die while you're gone? Or maybe it can't live while you're gone. Maybe someone's just playing a trick on you. You know, these kinds of fears are very real. And no matter how many times you hear me talk about it, or you hear many other people who say they've done this, or had near-death experiences where they've had it spontaneously take place, that's the kind of stuff that is really the most, we'll say, troublesome for most people to deal with. Because, let's face it, we are all illusioned enough to be significantly afraid of death. And it is illusion that causes that fear, by the way. All right, so some people also try at times to have just etheric experiences. You could actually, if you wanted to, leave your physical body and only stay in this realm, but in the electromagnetic portion as electrical energy. But the electrical energy is not in the same phase as TV waves and radio waves and all the other kinds of particle wave energy that is not alive. That energy, thankfully, being in a different phase does not interfere with the energy that is in phase, etherically or electromagnetically, for life. What does that mean? Well, through our whole system, there's interconnection with seven chakras. And those, the thing that's interconnecting them is, energies that are both, in some respects, particle waves that move through us, and as long as they're moving, and they're moving kind of nicely and balancing out the energy from one center to the next and going out of our bodies into through the earth, even into the sun, come back again. I mean, all this is going on, and it keeps our bodies enlivened, and we remain healthy. This is the great part of how the system's supposed to work. We are an electromagnetic wonder, much more complex than your TV set or computer. But the electromagnetics of it is in a phase that is in accord with the each chakra, the 1/7th of all the energy is going through approximately. And so you see it's a unique kind of energy in which the phase, now what is the phase? That means the way the energy moves in a certain direction and not in others, that phase is unique to human life. Each kind of life in each of the kingdoms has its own unique phase. And it's completely different from the phase of non-life or life that's in a very different kingdom from its own. So you could say the phase of life in the etheric realm, at least, and this is also true, by the way, for when we go on to live in the astral world, but the phase of life in the etheric realm dictates to a large extent what we think of as the differences in life in general. One type of life is aware of another type of life, mostly because there's some similarity in phase. When the senses are very much out of phase between two parts of life, or between a part of life and a part of non-life, there can be a distinct misunderstanding of the life to one life to the other, or of life to non-life. Now, non-life is life that has insufficient consciousness to allow energy to move in and out of itself, and to move in two different ways. One is in and out of itself in three dimensions of time and space that we're familiar with, plus time, which is a fourth. And then it has to be able to do one other thing. If it's a completed part of life, it has to be able to move in and out of the two dimensions of time and space. So it has to at least have an astral body of sorts, and it has to move energy back and forth to that astral body. That's a definition of life. If it doesn't have those, something that's almost life could borrow some of that ability from something that is life. That might be a parasite or something that's living in symbiosis with another part of life. But in any case, if it isn't doing either and it doesn't have that, it's not alive. It's pre-life, because pre-life is just preparing itself to develop these centers that move the energy in ways that I just described that produces life. And consciousness, it does the same thing. So consciousness has to be part of the same definition that we call life. Things that don't have the ability to do any of the things I just said would not have consciousness within the physical form and its etheric counterpart. So if I take a rock, and you say, now this is different than transcendentalism. For people who, a lot of people say, well, you're kind of a transcendentalist. I'm really not, because of this difference. A transcendentalist believe that if you took a rock and you kind of gave it enough attention, I don't know, maybe better your pet rock, remember those from 30 years ago, whatever, and you, I don't know, did something friendly to the rock or whatever, the rock might become conscious of you. By the definition I just gave you, rocks are not conscious because they can't move the energy in the ways I said. The most they can have would be one completed sense, any three now, one completed sense of pressure. But that sense is really not recorded within the rock itself. It doesn't have awareness of the pressure, in other words. The group soul, which is the thinking part of all rocks, that deals with that particular element of rock, gets some feedback, gets some information from this dimension, because the group soul is in the mental world, about what is happening to those rocks, to that rock. Possibly not even one rock, but maybe a million rocks, because one rock is pretty hard to determine anything from. The sense is so weak. But it collectively, it may get a very good impression, actually. So the group soul is the big player there. But the group soul is the soul for a huge number of forms that are mutable. They can change from one place to another. They can be brought together. They can break apart, all kinds of stuff like that. Can't do that with life. Life starts to develop individuality very, very soon in its development. And in the individuality is the kernel of developing consciousness. Remember, that's from the earlier definition. So when we examine this, it really is a fascinating idea that ultimately what we think as being not conscious, if it's alive, has a realm of consciousness. It's maybe extremely small, but that realm is too small to interrelate with by us, and too small for it to be conscious of most of anything other than the most rudimentary aspects of what keeps it alive, like water, certain minerals, maybe certain nucleic acids. Not much more than that. So very, 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 we'll say, old form, archaic is the name, of cells that developed billions of years ago here on Earth were just like that. They were slightly individual because they were onto themselves, but they were dependent so much on the oceans and the minerals and eventually sunlight, but before that, just on certain, we'll call it organic chemicals. Those things became very, we'll say, slightly conscious of their internal environment, but were not conscious of the external reality outside of things I just mentioned, like, oh, there's some salt here. They don't know what salt is, but whatever it is, they sure can use some. And it helps their electrical conductivities. It does certain things, and it balances out between one side of a membrane and another. It creates this and that, pressures inside of it against pressures outside. So salt is a good thing. Too much kills it. Too little, they die too. These kinds of, we'll call it both awareness and eventually a very, very, very slight consciousness, is of the most rudimentary that we will find. They happen in eventually archaic bacteria and archaic viruses of these sorts, and they are the beginnings of what we call life, because even before there are cells, there is an RNA nucleic chain that might be the beginning nucleic chain for all nucleic chains. And that may be the prototype upon which Earth was founded. But at any rate, that blueprint is so rudimentary that it could become almost anything. And that open architecture of nucleic acids is what allowed life to continue to grow. And the interesting thing about it is, I'm going to tell you this. If you look at the odds of, if you have a system, life that is spontaneously, quote-unquote, created by whatever mechanism, if you believe that God's not involved, would be much easier to stay alive and much easier to fend for itself than life which is open architecture and continuously trying to improve itself and improve its own individuality. So there's not a particular advantage to staying alive. As a matter of fact, there's a great risk in staying alive. As you develop these individual factors, everything becomes a creation, and every creation becomes a potential mistake that leads to the potential of being annihilated, extinction. So I'm just saying that as an aside for people to say, well, evolution proves everything. You don't need a God. Well, it doesn't work that way. It really doesn't. If it were true, I would admit to it. But it isn't true. The numbers don't support it. Math doesn't support it. If you want to get to human beings, you're going to need to have something we think of as evolution. But the odd thing about it is, you're never going to get to have human beings. Not in the time we've had, anyway. I mean, given enough time, anything could happen. But not in a few billion years. The odds are almost a dead-on odds, really hard against there being individuality and eventually the development of consciousness anywhere near the level of human beings if you don't have open architecture. And that open architecture of DNA is chosen as a means of use by the cells that did so, and then other life forms that came from it. It's so unbelievable that you, when you read about this stuff, you come to only one conclusion. This was predestined. This was designed to be this way. It doesn't have to be. Life more abundant would be a life with near no consciousness. It becomes more abundant, not less. Consciousness threatens life by causing it to create more, and in the creation process, it makes mistakes. It could lead into blind alleys. It can lead to extinction. But the odd thing about it is that it hasn't been the way that it's worked out. As a matter of fact, by the end of tonight's show, and I'm going to suggest this right now so you can think about it, I think you will find that consciousness is the reason that all life exists, and it exists for the purpose of growing consciousness, not for the purpose of growing form or body, or just staying physically alive. That isn't its purpose. Now, you could say the subconscious part of us wants to keep us alive, because if we're not physically alive, we can't be conscious in the physical realm anymore. We need a body. Okay, I'll go along with that. But that isn't our main purpose in being. It's a sub-purpose of sorts, but it isn't the main. As a matter of fact, you could claim consciousness exists in very small amounts in, say, an infant, and its main purpose may be to stay alive. But even so, in comparison to what non-conscious things have, an infant is growing in consciousness by leaps and bounds every hour, every day. Huge amounts of improvement. So we really, when we examine where consciousness leads us, it leads us to our Creator. The more we study consciousness, the more we can understand God. And the more, because consciousness is understanding. And the closer we become to being inclusive of all other people. So one measure of how much people understand God is their level of inclusiveness, their level of wise giving or love, their level of planning for the growth of all things, being soul-level conscious, which means seeing everything as a group of individuals. So it's just an amazing way of looking at the universe. And from that standpoint, I hope this beginning of the show is giving you this message. Consciousness within the kingdoms of life is really what the message and the part of God is. And to get that, you need to be, we'll say, open-minded and less grounded in material fact and more grounded on the side of there are lots of things we yet to understand. Tonight's show will help alleviate some of that, and then more if you've listened to all the other shows and other things that I've written, plus a lot of other people. There's a lot out there. Okay, we're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll learn a lot more about consciousness within the kingdoms of life.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's hidden meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hon, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, we're talking about consciousness within the kingdoms of life. And during the first section of the show, I defined what consciousness within the kingdoms of life is, and now I'm going to go into more detail through the kingdoms, giving better examples, maybe for some people, of what consciousness is actually doing there, and how this relates to God. Now, the interesting thing about this is that as the show progresses, this is an experiment, you all may experience some relatively small, I would think, expansion in consciousness. The reason for that is that's why I'm teaching in the first place, and it's specifically designed in the way I present shows to attempt to do that with some, as many possible of the audience. And so that is kind of like we're studying what is happening to us at the moment, which is a very interesting idea in itself. I'm not going to be able to go into the details of that very much because it's an individual change in each person, as I described in the last segment. So each of you may have an elevation in consciousness of some sort, but the way in which it takes place will be so individual and unique for you that for me to discuss it without there being a dialogue would be meaningless because each would have some different experiences, some different element in the way the consciousness changed. It would be a unique thing. All right, okay. Let's go into, we'll start again with what I ended with, which is the concept of the very beginnings of life. And here on Earth, Earth is a very, very tough planet because it has two qualities in it. Number one, it's a dense physical world. That in itself makes it a hard place while life is focused on the dense physical to both sense, gain information that becomes knowledge from those senses, and the most important thing is to become conscious, using that knowledge in creative, connective ways, becoming more inclusive of other life forms, and being able to eventually grow itself both in consciousness and in many other ways as well. Humans go to the level of growing all the other kingdoms along lower than themselves, along with themselves. So really interesting. They already destroy them. They do one of the two usually. Okay, so we have then this interesting effect that leads life closer to God. God is patient. because it takes billions of years to develop the most rudimentary consciousness levels in even multicellular microscopic creatures. When you get to the level that a cell is capable of creating complex patterns of interaction with its environment, that is about as, we'll say, about as important as anything in terms of the beginnings of development of consciousness. Now, what does that mean? Well, I'll put it in practical terms. Remember, this part of the show now is really going to be more practical. If you're a cell and you need to, you want to grow, you need energy. Now, the energy can come from heat. It can come from chemical reactions. It could come from electrical reactions. And it can come from solar energy. So you have these sources, and some people rarely, but there are some creatures that we think it was true, might even get some of their energy from radioactive substances. I know that sounds unbelievable. They just discovered some bacteria that do that. Okay, so talk about glowing. So here's the thing. The bottom line is that you've got to have a source of creating energy so that you can sustain form and you can grow in a physical sense and simultaneously develop the slightest, most rudimentary forms of consciousness. And when cells are able to do this, especially when they are able to do this with other cells, it becomes a greater, we'll say, impetus to develop consciousness. Individual cells, when they do this, if they don't collectively work with or involve themselves with other cells, that means they have asexual forms of reproduction. They virtually live their lives with no other interaction with anything else other than themselves. And that solipsist viewpoint of a cell grows consciousness least. And it was the beginning of our archaic cells, but they didn't stay like that long. Cells chose a more rigorous and difficult expression of themselves. That expression requires the collective consciousness, group consciousness, besides individual consciousness, both balanced within the cells, where there is a symbiotic relationship at the minimum and possibly a collective consciousness. But a symbiotic, at a minimum, where the cells start to use different forms of energy. Now, some of the cells will use energy from the heat of vents in the ocean near volcanic activity. And they get a lot of energy from that, and then they transfer certain sulfur and iron ions and stuff, and they're able to generate the energy they need by the movement of heat going through the chemistry within them and the sulfur that's in abundance out of these same vents and iron and certain other substances that allows them to produce both heat from heat energy, which gives them lots of energy, because sometimes these vents run like 600-700 degrees. You can say, water boils at 212. No, not when the pressure is that high. It's way, way below the surface of the ocean. But that's why a pressure cooker cooks so hot, because you got a lot more pressure and the temperature's way higher. But anyway, temperature goes up the inverse of the pressure. The point is that you've got to look at it from the standpoint that the process comes from the desire of both the creator and the created, the self, to eventually develop more consciousness, not to develop more life. Why is that true? Well, because the cells would be a lot more successful if they didn't have to hang around other cells and figure out how they're going to work together, and the slightest thing goes wrong with all their neighbors, and they're gone too. So the chances of survival are not increased by what we call group behavior. Now, most people say, oh, well, why not? Well, because the slightest thing that goes wrong with one cell can have an effect on numerous other cells. Whereas when you have a single cell, it's really dependent only on itself, and if it keeps splitting itself 1,000 times in its lifetime, it'll get far ahead, far more ahead than if it has to be part of some organized community, even if it isn't yet an organism. But even just a community of cells is not necessarily a more successful way of just creating life if that's what life is here for. So consciousness becomes the bottom line. But we don't see that. We don't understand that. We just think it's all about life. But you see, it's not. And so to those cells, they have a motivation inside them, which really has to do with the mind of God itself, which speaks to them, if you want to call it that. It's actually a group soul, but it doesn't matter. And it's speaking to them that consciousness is what it seeks. Life without consciousness is no life at all. So even the most rudimentary cells are seeking life. They might have the most minimal level of it, but they're still seeking it. And this seeking of life leads them to make choices that allows them to join and to become more complex, even though in terms of survival, that is not necessarily an advantage. In terms of just plain old, I gotta live kind of thing. It's risky, and there'll be times when they face very bad problems. From the specialization, over-specialization can lead to extinction because of a sudden change of environment. All kinds of things can start happening. Eventually, you have competition because life can only have, there's only so much of everything to go around. Okay, and then you have other cells that say, the cells that use the heat and the sulfur and all this other stuff, they may become one kind of life, right? And then they may become a kind of life that eventually becomes what we consider to be bacteria, real bacteria, not just archaic forms of almost bacteria. Then in addition, you can have some life that says, hey, wait a second, there's the sun. All I need is oxygen and everything's cool. Problem is that once the oxygen develops, it becomes poisonous to the same cell unless they develop photosynthesis. You start thinking about that and say, wait a second. Say that again? Okay, I'll say it again. The same cells that need to develop photosynthesis also have to exchange carbon dioxide and give off oxygen, and they have to have a cycle that they go through with this. And the process that they use, which is contingent upon this, is fatal to them if oxygen develops and they don't have photosynthesis because they're betting the farm that they're going to have it. Or, in reverse, if they continue to use a carbon dioxide basis, they eventually will extinct themselves anyway because the amount of carbon dioxide will continually drop in the atmosphere and oxygen will invariably go up because oxygen is part of carbon dioxide and they're using it up and there's nothing replacing it. So that would be a problem. And you say, well, wait a second, aren't those vents putting out carbon dioxide too? Yeah. As a matter of fact, it's thought that some of the bacteria or bacteria-like cells that were forming around vents eventually got this idea that, hey, I don't want to have to be only sticking around a vent the rest of my life. Be interesting to swim over to over there, wherever that is, and maybe get together with those cells over there that are whatever they're doing. So looking at it from this standpoint, one thing also comes to mind, and that is that how does the cell know 100 million years ahead of time that it's got to change its whole design of gaining energy and making a chemical reaction from solar light that is inherently impossible once it moves away from vents and doesn't get enough carbon dioxide. As the atmosphere of carbon dioxide drops, it's got to be able to do something about this whole process. And how does it know that other cells in its neighborhood and elsewhere are going to symbiotically reverse the process? So the whole thing develops a thing called homeostasis. How does it know that? And if it doesn't know that, then why don't things go very bad eventually for this entire system falling apart? Yet they bet on it. They went that direction. There was no way to naturally select for the process. Natural selection would not have gone that direction because the Earth only became highly oxygenized, not by the bacteria themselves that were producing eventually oxygen. They only produced a 1 or 2% level or 3% level. It came from a decrease in the amount of volcanic action underneath Earth, which also caused Earth to start cooling off, by the way. And there were much lower volcanic action reduced the CO2 levels a lot. And all these cells are starting to say, oh, wait a second, we've got to create a system here that's going to allow us to live away from vents, not live off the heat, and to gain some kind of other mechanism, which we're going to use the sun, to change carbon dioxide into oxygen, but then some other kinds of cells are going to be around to change the oxygen back into carbon dioxide. Yeah. Okay, how is this all going to happen? Well, it's a very fine balance. And although you could live with it for thousands of years before any disaster might happen, millions of years are almost completely out, and tens to hundreds of millions of years never could happen. It's the opposite of natural selection. So you're creating a system that is so complicated and is required that you have so many different pieces moving at the same time, and they are not directly connected with each other. You've got to have this incredible balance that comes from consciousness, not from natural selection or from the forces of evolution. Evolution is very forceful, the way it works. But it would take many, 10 times as long, or maybe never, that cells would ever move in this particular direction to be able to change themselves into the symbiotic relationship with the cells and with the nature of the environment. What, they know that the Earth is going to stop putting out CO2 at the levels that it has been, and now it's suddenly going to move in this direction? And it takes them a million years to change that way? So it would take them a million years to possibly change back? And in the meantime, that's a big gamble. Consciousness. Consciousness is coming more from higher beings. Okay, I'll go all of that. It's coming from God. But even within the cell itself, it has some freedom to participate in this. It doesn't have to do this. It seeks it. It seeks those things that raises its consciousness and makes it more individual while it's also growing to some extent group consciousness. It is becoming more interdependent on all other forms of life. You can see that happening while it is becoming more of an individual. Wow. All right. Now, that was one example. There's a lot of other chemical and electrical issues, but I'm trying to make it as simple as possible to show how this whole thing is really, it's counterintuitive to believe that it comes from just killing off so many of something, and the stronger survive, but they survive to do what? To become more conscious. They don't survive to just grow and And evolution would say that is what they would do. Consciousness is not a life-producing effect for those things that have very limited amounts of it. For human beings, you could argue the opposite, but we'll get to that. All right, so in our first step in trying to understand consciousness on a planet like Earth, Earth, to begin with, is a relatively difficult planet because it's a very dense planet. It's so incredibly dense that what we think of as its lower density part, 70% or give or take of it, is water. But, you know, water is not all that light. I mean, carry a few gallons of water and see what I'm talking about. It's a pretty heavy substance. Now, it's not anywhere near as heavy as the equivalent amount of iron or something. But it's still, you know, a cubic foot of water it's like 50-some-odd pounds. Water's about 8 pounds per gallon or 7.5 gallons. It's close to 60 pounds. And so a cubic foot is very heavy of water. Now, a cubic foot of iron might be double that, but the point is that it is still a dense thing. And water is not by far the densest thing that it takes to create a life form. So when we examine this from the standpoint of, whoa, there is a very strong, we'll call it, gravitational element to the planet. Right, gravity is high. What we call 1G, which is the gravity of Earth, is very difficult for life to exist in. Now, the offsetting to that is if the life has some saline aspects and is in water, most of the gravitational effects of the Earth are negated because of a factor called buoyancy and the relationship of something that is filled with a salty water inside of itself compared to the water around it, it will tend to float. Yeah, it does tend to do that. Now, not always. As a matter of fact, if you've got actual salt grains in there, it would probably sink. But at the relative levels that is inside, which is a very small amount of salt, and certain other chemicals, by the way, the result is there's actually a buoyancy that has developed. Neutral buoyancy would be at approximately the same salt level as oceans. And guess where most of the creatures were found? They were found in oceans, but usually in little tidal pools close to the shore of an ocean is where a lot of life starts. But other parts were found in the deep oceans by vents, and other parts of life they have been found in places we don't even know about. But for looking at it from that standpoint, there's a good reason for life to begin in the oceans. Number one, there's an abundance of chemistry in the oceans that would be difficult to find in one place on the physical surface of the dry land surface. And that's because waves keep melting or wiping out some of the energy, the chemicals along the shoreline. And also rains come pouring down and bring it from even deeper parts of the continent. So basically the oceans are constantly bathed in new nutrients coming from the minerals, some of them becoming more complex minerals, eventually becoming nucleic acids, found in land and soil mixed with salt water. And then the ocean floor itself sometimes gets stirred up a bit, sometimes. But the more important thing is coming from the surface areas. And this soup allows a lot of life forms to make a living just by exchanging some of those chemicals that are readily surrounding them all the time with those they have inside themselves. The exchange of the chemicals produces electrical energy, and they can live for a long time actually doing that. addition, the added heat, as I suggested. But there's a couple of other things. Eventually, some of these life forms get very attuned to looking for nucleic acids of various different kinds, sometimes in molecules that are like RNA. Some of them are prototypes of RNA. And some of these cells eat RNA. How do they do it? Well, they come across some RNA, and the RNA gets absorbed through their membrane, usually into a couple of areas in the outside of the cell that it has created to grab a hold of those RNAs and bring them closer to the nucleus. The interesting part about this is those cells are the forerunners of animals. And some of the cells, as we know, stay bacteria. They grow into, instead of archaic bacteria, they grow into bacteria, period. And some cells that are archaic bacteria join animal cells, or they join the other kind of cell that uses sunlight, for the most part, in its kingdom, and they become a plant. So you've got like a species going on, and then there's also in-between kinds of things, like this fungi that kind of have some plant qualities to them, a lot of plant qualities, but at the same time, they don't use photosynthesis. Not all plants have to use photosynthesis. It's not necessarily a requirement, but most do. Okay, so some cells are looking for RNA and other forms of nucleic acids. Nucleic acids are spontaneously forming due to radioactive elements that are in the ground that are causing slight changes in isotopes and genes. Well, not genes. Eventually genes. But isotopes and chemicals that become able to warp around each other and become and fold around each other, which become these nucleic acids. And odd things like that. Once a nucleic acid is made, it can replicate itself in some circumstances, in a lot of circumstances. And when cells absorb nucleic acids, they're absorbing new ways of doing old things because the nucleic acids may have unique ways of recombining with some other nucleic acids that they stumble onto and eat, so to speak. So they're growing in leaps and bounds. The plants are a little or a lot slower because their method of growth comes through solar, for the most part, radiation, and they need to have enough carbon dioxide so they can around them, usually a few percent, a couple percent is more than enough, and they then take that in, and as cells get more efficient, it could become far less than 1%, so for an immature cell, it takes more, and they change that, some of that carbon dioxide gets changed into oxygen while they create sugars. They take the carbon away from the oxygen that's in the carbon dioxide. They release oxygen, and the energy that was holding, that was bonding the carbon to the oxygen, now becomes bound with hydrogen. Where does the hydrogen come from? Well, it comes from either hydrogen sulfate, if you're by vents, or it comes from water itself. The water that they have around them, they actually release more oxygen from the water and get some hydrogen. You get H2O, two H's, one O. Release a little oxygen, get twice as much hydrogen, combine the carbon with the hydrogen, and sometimes a phosphate, a group or certain other kinds of chemicals, and you can end up with sugars, and you can also make eventually proteins, which then become nucleic acids. So the cells can make nucleic acids, and the cells that do it through photosynthesis we call plants. And the cells that do it by eating nucleic acids from plants and from any other source that they have, and they do come from a lot of other sources, actually, because around vents and other places, nucleic acids can can be spontaneously created by the hydrogen sulfide reactions. So you get all this stuff, and they can, amazingly, grow by just directly latching on to the nucleic acid, nucleic proteins. And it's an amazing array of change that can take place in a relatively short time. And it causes very fast growth. And the cells that are plants give a lot of food to the cells that aren't. Some of them have a symbiotic relationship with each other. As the cells that eat the parts of the plants, because some of the parts of the plants provide sugars, which are pure, are energy, because they have a substance in them that causes energy in a cell when it breaks apart. And that chemical substance is very important, and we all have it. But when it breaks apart, it releases a huge amount of energy, and most cells actually use this as a vehicle. So we can do that. Cells can do that. All animals depend upon it, because it's a faster way of developing energy than a very slow way of photosynthesis. Plants sometimes use sugars too, though. But they mostly use sugars to develop a way of reproducing eventually. They don't use sugars to move much. They're not big on moving. Animals are animated. Plants are not. You see, just the words themselves tell us something about them. Okay. So, here we have an interesting, fascinating system, because at the very beginning of our planet, and Earth being this unique planet that has this first characteristic of high gravity coming in, producing all these unique things where things have to get into the ocean because that's the place where it's easiest to deal with this high gravity. But the odd thing about it is, it's a lot easier for life to live in the ocean than it is to come up on land. Think about it. In the ocean, you don't have to contend with much gravity issues. The amount of energy you need is a fraction of the amount of energy you would need just to take a couple steps on Earth. I mean, the physical Earth. And it doesn't make any sense. Dry land is like treacherous. The gravitational forces are huge, and the reality is movement becomes extremely difficult. So why do it? Well, some people believe that the oceans became so crowded. I saw one version of this, actually. The oceans became so crowded because there was just so much darn life out there that some life just got pushed out, poor life, and went looking for stuff on land. Really? Here's my explanation of it. The oceans were never filled enough to produce anything other than more abundant levels of types of life. We were nowhere near a saturation point any time that we know from the fossil record. If you look at how much life there was per cubic meter or something, it's nowhere near what it eventually became later on. So during the times we're talking about, billions of years ago, that just didn't happen. Well, if it didn't happen based upon what we know of fossils, then how come life eventually came out and was on land? First was the plants, right? Well, if you go back like a half a billion years ago, some of these cells that we're talking about that would have been what we eventually call, they were archaic, but eventually became plant cells, found that they could make a deal with the bacteria cells that were already kind of living sort of on land, if you want to call that, in pools of water. They kind of, if they got together in those same pools, they could allow some of the bacteria to bring some of the nutrients they need from the soil. Like, they provide small amounts of the sugar they produce to the bacteria. Bacteria say, yeah, lunch. And the plant cells are just tickled because they get to go into something they really like to be, and that's in the sunlight. You see, they like the sunlight. And in the water, they really can't do much because you get a few meters below the surface and the sun's energy is tremendously diffused, not much of it. They like to be up on the land where the sun is really coming through. But up there, they're going to need certain energy that they can't get, certain chemicals they can't get, and the bacteria are going to help them out. Sometimes fungi help them out, which is another cousin to them, and they work together. It's a symbiotic relationship. And then the amazing thing is the increased sunlight causes them to go crazy. Instead of being a flip-floppy kind of thing in the ocean that kind of just floats around or is attached to the bottom of the ocean in very shallow areas, because there wasn't much plant life in deeper areas because it couldn't get the sun. So, but now the whole expansion area of the planet could be created by, or could be enjoyed by plants, as long as they had their bacteria friends with some fungi, to help them get their roots stimulated by the needed minerals and other substances that the bacteria make, including certain nucleic acids that plants couldn't find a way of making themselves. And at the same time, bacteria said, well, we'll feed on your roots a little bit if you won't mind. He said, sure, I got plenty of sugar. If you like some sugar down there, have some. And so it all works together. And eventually the plants provide more of a pool-like environment as they grow, so that the pools are no longer just where the waves float over and the tidal pools, but eventually the plants create changes in the environment so that there's all kinds of pools all over the place by the fact that their roots and the branches, et cetera, defray and or collect water. And water becomes their way of making music with the land. But as they do that, they also bring their bacteria comes with them in the land, and it just spreads. It spreads all over the place. Eventually, you got the whole planet pretty well covered with plants, and they're pumping out oxygen, huge amounts of oxygen. And not every plant is photosynthesis, but most of them. And so huge amounts of oxygen are pouring, and of course, amazingly, all the cells that were running around not needing or using and even finding oxygen toxic now suddenly find that they were prepared for millions of years to use oxygen. Now, when you have an anaerobic cell, that means a cell that doesn't use oxygen, it uses, it creates energy 1/100th, give or take, of the percentage of its time and in its effort, we'll say, effort and time, to create any kind of movement. So they're not all that movable. But when you start using oxygen in the cycle, and especially the chemical that produces the most of it, the results are you can get up to a 100-fold increase in the efficiency. And now you can start developing things like muscles and things that move other parts of the cell or collection of cells. And it is amazing. They're not exactly muscles in a cell. One cell creature wouldn't exactly have a muscle, but they have little cilia, and those things can be moved. But the idea here is that now you have the true foundation of animal life. And a lot of people say, what came first, plants or animals? And it kind of did develop together, but plants had the jump on the system because animals required more and more oxygen, and plants would provide that over time. And also, they require a limitation on CO2, and if they're aerobic. And they can't have too much CO2, it'll toxify them, whereas too much oxygen toxifies an anaerobic cell. So an archaic animal cell would be a cell that is a maybe like yeast or some kind of cell that is sort of developing itself eventually into an animal-like creature. Yeast are not animals, but more in the direction of that. But they can survive in a high CO2 environment. But you can't survive in a high CO2 environment if you're an oxygen-loving creature. The CO2 at levels beyond 2% become very bad. And at 10%, you might actually not be able to sustain life. Most people don't know this, but you don't need a super high amount of CO2 around you to die, because the CO2 is heavier than air, and it will smother you if it gets high enough in content, because you'd have to be flying above it. There might be more oxygen, but it's above the CO2 where you're not. So it could choke you out. Okay. So looking at how this whole thing is working, we have animals, archaic beginning animal life forms, working with plants, and the two are balancing each other. Some are in the sea where gravity is easiest to deal with. And that's where most life, animal life particularly, begins. All animal life actually starts in the oceans. And plant life starts in the oceans too, but it becomes strangely far more abundant on the dry land, where there's very direct sunlight and where they've got this new thing going with their bacteria and fungi to symbiotically work together to take over the dry land. And they do it. And actually change and sculpture and even rocks. They break it apart with their roots and get new minerals into the environment, all kinds of stuff. This is what the plants are doing with their friends. It's all done because consciousness is the bottom line. It's a big risk for life to take these huge leaps, which require more and more consciousness on the part of life to survive. That's strange, if you believe in purely evolution. Now, it's not so strange for people who believe in human beings, because human beings have gone far beyond the animals and consciousness. We're going to talk about that, of course. But it is strange when you think about it in terms of these little tiny microscopic creatures making decisions that are not easy to say, they did that, but how come? Remember, you gotta start changing thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of years beforehand, because it's such a slow process, to come up with a really tremendously different environment that you can live in. I mean, you don't just wake up one day and say, gee, I think I'm going to live in a world that's oxygen focused rather than carbon dioxide focused. By the way, carbon dioxide was not the only chemical that was in the atmosphere. There was methane and other things. So that it was really a toxic place for anything alive today. But for then it wasn't. A lot of the anaerobic life forms were quite successful. There was tons of them. And there was much less oxygen life forms at some periods after them. So why didn't life go back to the more abundant? Why didn't it stay there? Or why didn't it get extinct if things changed? Not from it, because it only had a small proportion of the change. It changed. Everybody says, well, life changed itself. No, it didn't. It didn't. Not enough. The planet changed. Who's behind the planet? Okay, so, and the life had to know a million years ahead of time. Okay, figure that one out. Now, where does this lead us about consciousness? Life and consciousness have an intimate relationship. The benefit of consciousness is not that you stay alive longer. Even to these little cells we're talking about, archaic at that, combining some bacteria with a plant cell to become something else, I mean, weird stuff. I mean, they actually do this internally. I would talk about external realities where they're living at the roots, but some of the cells actually join together before that ever happened. Yeah, it's true. Pieces. Plants are very, very experimental. Yeah, they tried a lot of things. And there's a few animal cells that did the same thing. Yeah. Okay, but why would they do this? What is the basis? Because I wrote this textbook called Life's Hidden Meaning. What it says about? What's the hidden meaning of life? It's about, in many respects, the development of consciousness. Not just in life, but specifically in human life. And the interest and beyond. And so the interesting thing is, when we examine this, here we have a process that it is so esoteric, meaning hidden, that the creatures that are doing it have there's no way that they could be doing it because they just want to stay alive, because it isn't necessarily going to keep them alive from the relative level of input that they have in a truly evolutionary sense. They have to have something else that they're living for. And what they're living for, now this is going to sound strange, is a hidden meaning. And the hidden meaning is to become more conscious. Life becomes meaningful based upon the level of consciousness that life has. Now, this is all explained, of course, in that textbook I told you about. But putting it in the simplest fashion, we don't exist in other kinds of life forms, even down to the very lowest, don't exist, just to be alive. We exist to have meaning, but now we have to define that, right? Meaning is the ability to self-create. And self is the expression of consciousness. Meaning is the ability to self-create, meaning you can create yourself. You can create more of the self, and the self can create more of everything else. And the self is the same, it's a synonym for consciousness. Oh. So life forms are here to create consciousness because it's meaningful for them. Even cells, the most primitive of cells, sought this. We know it because they did it, not because we guess it. They did it, and they did it against the probabilities and the evolutionary explanations of life. So it's the meaning of life that projects life to create more of itself, and eventually, because it's group conscious as well, it helps to create the life of others. Wow. So it not only wants to create more meaning in its life by creating more of itself, it may give up its life to create more meaning for new life. Isn't that the idea of birthing and the progeneration of life? And doesn't that make sense when we compare asexual development of life, which was the most common form of the earliest cells, to eventually sexual development, where more than one cell join together and produce a much more likely, faster growing in both developmental terms and in consciousness life form? Cells that split are almost exactly like the cells that came from. Almost. There's slight changes due to gamma radiation and other kinds of things. But most of the time, you could say they're just like duplicates. But eventually, asexual becomes sexual. Now, some life forms remain asexual. There's a reason for that. If I have time to, then I'll tell you another time. I can go into why that happens. I'll give you some reason for it. And that is that consciousness grows best when some life it drags its feet in producing consciousness, so that the other life has to find a way to deal with the adversity of it, and at the same time find ways to even help the other life become more conscious. So there's even an advantage to that. So some asexual life is actually good to have. It actually puts some degree of pressure on another life to become more conscious, even though it itself may not as grow as consciousness as fast because it's not being sexual. Wow. So, the secret of why life is to develop meaning, which ultimately is the same as to develop consciousness. Wow. Okay. So now we know what the show is about. I've been thinking about this for a long time now. All right, so if that's true, and it is, in my opinion, then we have a totally different paradigm now about evolution. Let's go back to my friend evolution. Evolution does exist in terms of form. It helps to develop many kinds of forms. We can prove this by simply growing peas, right? You go back to the middle of the 19th century, Mendel and the whole thing with the peas and everything. But the thing is that all it proves is that you can change the form, how sweet they are, what color they are, how fast they grow, whether or not they do this or that, and by recombining the offspring, etc. But the point is, that's called hybridization. The point is that that in itself is coming from the consciousness of something greater enacted upon some poor thing, Peapod. And it's the consciousness that wants greater meaning in its life so it can understand heredity and eat nicer peas and find ways of growing more of them and better, more nutritional, less water, that kind of thing. Okay, all of that is part of the way this plan works. It is God in disguise everywhere. It's so hard to understand how people can't see this. Because the mechanical model just doesn't apply. The chaotic model doesn't apply. Far from chaos. And far from mechanics or math. It's not supported by math, it doesn't work. It's not supported by chaos, chaos goes the reverse direction. And it's not supported by straight forms of evolution, survival of the fittest, the ability to change based upon environmental pressure, all of those things, adaptability, all of those things that are part of evolution are only about form. And then, only to the level that the consciousness of that which is part of life is not great enough to ignore it and go in its own direction to get more meaning. Evolution be damned. Something to really consider here. So we're looking at the idea of free choice and a non-deterministic system with consciousness being the real reward of life coming from meaning and individual development. And it is obvious, if you look at the spectrum of life without trying to examine the nitty-gritties of a small fraction, a small, species or subspecies of a particular kingdom, which is unfortunate because if you study that, you miss the big picture, and you may miss the fact that those things that you're looking at are trying to find more meaning in their life, too. But you see it as a mechanical model because you've eliminated, through a lack of consciousness, the wider, bigger picture. Plants grow, in part, because their sugars and some of their nucleic acids, proteins, help grow other life. They don't do it because they have to. Yes, there's some level of symbiosis, but many plants, it's not a symbiotic experience for, literally. So why are they doing it? Because to feed other life in a group conscious way, for the plant's group soul and for even the individual plants, they benefit from it, is meaningful. It provides meaning for their existence, which makes them grow in consciousness ever so slightly, the more they produce. Some plants, most plants actually, produce life really that is below them, still in the bacterial and fungi range. But that symbiotic relationship is still inherent and meaningful for them. And then there's something else, which is a whole other ball game. There are beings that are energy beings that have intimate relationships of meaning and support for life in the energy community. It's so esoteric for people. I don't talk about it very much. But it's true. Energy itself is trying to develop consciousness. But it does it in the most bizarre of ways. First, it becomes more and more dense to provide the forms for all other life, like plants. It provides food, but the food it provides is gravity, as well as minerals, and electrical change in, we'll say, from one chemical to another, and eventually also protein bonding. It does all that by becoming denser and denser and denser in different dimensions of time and space until it reaches a physical dimension, where it becomes, in the material or physical world, extremely dense. As it does this, energy loses consciousness. Loses. It doesn't gain it. It's sacrificing consciousness to gain meaning in life by helping everything else grow. Now you could say, well, why would it want to do that? Well, because this is its way of truly gaining consciousness faster than other kinds of life. Believe it or not, energy actually grows in consciousness more rapidly than other forms of life do because it gives all of its consciousness in as a sacrifice to other life, and it does so knowingly and consciously, at least in the beginning of the process. When it reaches the most dense level, its consciousness is virtually vacant, or may be vacant. And then at that point, it starts to develop more consciousness again by helping life and the souls of life, especially group souls, to do a better job. It becomes an active, eventually, being or beings that take on characteristics of eventually soul-like creatures. Some of them are much lower than soul-like creatures, but most of them eventually become soul-like creatures. And then eventually they become super souls. Go beyond the level of a human soul in consciousness. They do all this in the same period that it takes just human life to develop. That's how fast energy can develop itself by sacrificing so much. And again, it's all done for meaning. The more consciousness eventually grows, the more meaning there is. And you have to start off with pretty good consciousness where energy starts is in a place called the Atmic realm. It starts with pretty good consciousness there, better than human beings, actually. And it says, you know what? I've got to get together with spirit, which is the thought of God, and create life forms in the lower realms, and I've got to give up my own consciousness, so spirit can be freer to use me without my interference. And then I'm going to grow in consciousness when I turn the corner, when I get most dense, when I'm freed up from a life form for a period of time, I'm going to grow in consciousness and become kind of special kind of creatures that eventually become great souls. on around us, and we don't even know it. Whoa. And the thing about it is that, again, it's that sacrifice, which is creation. It's another way of being creative, is sacrifice, so that others can grow more, that develops so much meaning. So even as energy loses consciousness, it's not losing meaning, it's gaining meaning. But how is that so? There is a conflict. Let me go back a half hour. Didn't I say, didn't you hear me say, that consciousness grows when you have more meaning? Right? So how come what's going on with the energy that's getting denser and denser and denser? How is that possible? Ah, here's the point. Time. We don't understand time very well. When energy becomes more dense, it is separated more from space, and the effects of time are almost zero on it. It doesn't experience much time. We do, because we have a lot of consciousness. It experiences almost nothing. So a rock for 100 million years locked in the mantle of the earth and eventually pops out of a volcano and whatever. That, to that rock, that was maybe just a few seconds. It didn't have any bearing on its time issue. It's absent the lack of meaning that comes from the awareness of a lot of time in which you're doing virtually nothing. It doesn't have that experience. We do, and we suffer, and we lose consciousness when a lot of time is wasted by us or by others. So fascinating about this thing about time is it kind of protects energy from suffering as a result of loss of consciousness, because the consciousness that it has lost, which is could be for millions of years, is like seconds to it, or maybe minutes or days. It isn't any really long relative period of time. Ah, so that explains. It's the time thing. Yeah. Wow. This is so fascinating. So time is different for rocks than it is for us. Well, it kind of makes sense. I mean, how else could it be if you think about it? Okay. So, getting back to now what's going on with these energy things. Eventually, some of them help out. They're called devas. They help out plants. They help out some types of animals. They also can even have effects on people, although they don't particularly care for people much because they see people as selfish and meddlesome and many times undoing much of the work they try to achieve. So they're not particularly fond of people. And it's not that easy to directly experience them because they will avoid letting you have that experience if possible. Now, they're not little elves that are running around with pots of gold or whatever, and, you know, leprechauns. Those are projections of human fantasy onto a more subtle and much more meaningful kind of life. There's even parts of life, if you want to call it that, in the energy kingdom that lives within the earth itself. The very mantle, the heat, the movement of the earth really has its own kind of thing. It's hard to understand this because we don't know what that means. But if we look at everything as having some element to either being pre-life or life, then it's much easier to accept these things. Let's ask ourselves this. Is a rock alive? No, it's not alive based upon the definition I gave at the beginning of the show. But it is pre-life because eventually, in its own, it will develop itself up the energy kingdom ladder. And as it does so, it becomes part of many, eventually almost every kind of life that is growing, gets to enjoy some of that from the form side, while spirit is really the forming element in it. And then when it's outside of that context, it's growing its own life into beings that eventually become super souls guardian angels or solar angels. They never were human, and they never will really be human, because when they join back with spirit, they join humans when they are out of the human kingdom. So they're not humans anymore. They're superhumans, spiritual beings. They never become human. They never experience the human kingdom, except as, unfortunately, the result of humans' folly and social and selfishness. So it's part of the experience, and they accept it. They don't necessarily find us to be an enjoyable kind of creature, but they know the necessity that we succeed. If we fail, if humans fail in any planet, that planet is doomed. Life cannot continue. That's bad news. Why is that true? Because humans are the bridge between life finding meaning through growing other life and life finding meaning through growing all life, because it's growing more of God at the same time. Because it is aware of God, it wants to co-create God. That's a human being. Animals, plants, protozoans, bacteria, they don't do that. They don't get their meaning from that. They get their meaning from all kinds of other subtle ways of being involved with and helping to create life. But they're not involved with directly understanding or creating more of God, their own creator. Why not? Their consciousness is not high enough. They don't have the consciousness. You got to have the consciousness combined between the heart and crown chakra, the two centers that experience God. And that has to, you have to be pretty conscious in those centers to be conscious at some level that there is a creator. And some people are pretty conscious in those two centers, but do not yet believe God exists. Why not? Because too much of their life has come from meanings that are sub-God. They may be good things. They may be, you know, they're great humanitarians and they go out and do good things for everybody. They're not necessarily bad people by any stretch. Some of them are great people. But the point is that they've spent so much of their time and focus in that way, they have not allowed these centers to become fully conscious. They have stifled the consciousness to limit the meaning in their life to the development of interrelationships of people and form, rather than a relationship that is greater based upon consciousness itself. They don't seek to live for consciousness. They seek to live for an outcome. It could be a very good outcome, but it's the true sign of humanitarianism and the true sign of some forms of progressivism, and also the sign of people who, even if they aren't selfish or greedy, are entrenched in various ways through about the world being a material manifestation. That being the case, they're very fond of evolution because it's material all the way. And they're also fond of the belief that there's a finality to existence, so they don't need to concern themselves with the terror they create within themselves. They're terrified of death because they don't believe they go on. But at the same time, they believe that everybody's going to die and nobody's going to survive, and you just turn off the lights and there's nothing else going on. So they don't have to raise their consciousness to develop more meaning in life. They try to develop their life through external realities. Those people are doomed to eventually become imprisoned by their own lack of growth. Because no matter how much you spend your time doing all the things I just said, and some of them do great things, by the way, without the biggie, without being here to create the meaning of relationship with God, life becomes eventually not meaningful enough. Eventually. It may be the last 5 minutes of it, or the last 5 years, but it hits eventually. Now, it could hit, obviously, when a person dies, because oh, surprise, surprise, I'm not dead. My consciousness is here. I know I'm still existing. I don't have that physical body anymore, but I still have this electromagnetic etheric body for at least days, if not weeks or months. And then whack, boom, I'm in a new dimension of time and space, went through some kind of light tunnel or something. And there I am, and I'm just as alive. Actually, I'm more alive here. Matter of fact, my awareness is a little better. I can have a lot more consciousness in some ways. I'm not conscious of anything physical, because there's nothing physical here. But, man, my senses are, like, really amazing. I can sense things miles, if not hundreds of miles away. I can create things with just my imagination. Just amazing stuff. Well, yeah. I guess when someone finds themselves in that position, they no longer believe that there's nothing after death. Right? Okay, yeah. Now, I know there's got to be people listening to me right now who are in this quandary about this question. And that's why you're in a quandary. You're in a quandary because what tortures all human beings is that. Because we are hardwired to find meaning in life. Even when we doubt, even when we absolutely believe there's no life after death, there's no God, it's just, you know, someone turns the lights off, goodbye. It's disquieting. It produces great anxiety and fear in us to believe that. And then we try to get rid of the fear and anxiety by doing a lot of other things on the surface and in the physical world. But it doesn't change the bottom line. We're still driven to find meaning in life. And once you've done as much as you can with the little self, there's lots of things you do. Like you learn to play the piano. Guitars are interesting. You do a lot of things. But, and there's no reason you can't keep doing those. But if you don't also try to create more of God in life and God everywhere, the meaning of all those small things diminishes while all the big things of creating more of God in everything grows and becomes infinitely meaningful and never goes away. As you do good, great deeds for others, for them to do the same, not to give them something or to be special or for them to be special, but to actually create more meaning in everybody's life. As you do those things, the boredom, the fear, the fatigue, the lack of faith, the lack of understanding, the great burden diminishes and eventually becomes light. So, the kingdoms have within them a band of consciousness that is forever growing, we hope, and is individual and also group conscious. And it has a ring of, we'll say, separation between itself and the consciousness of the next kingdom and the one below it. Why? Well, we already know that evolution causes animals and plants and everything else to eventually create strife and interference, survival of the fittest, right? But at the same time, consciousness does the reverse. Consciousness causes people to be, and creatures, all kinds of creatures and plants, to be able to grow more, and to grow more abundantly, and to grow more in meaning. Consciousness is the big ticket. However, because the kingdoms themselves represent, we'll call it semi-discrete levels of consciousness, one kingdom can adversely affect another kingdom if it falls out of balance and becomes less conscious in relative terms than the kingdom above it. Then it could actually become a detriment to the growth of God. to protect us. The kingdom system itself was created by God. How was it created? Well, we know when we take a look at the cells and everything, the archaic cells, they differentiated themselves so that they could develop a symbiotic, co-creative, codependent, and individual creation of themselves as well, in other words, differentiation. And it became animals and plants and bacteria, fungi, yeast guys, and all kinds of guys, all kinds of different life. But all of that leads to sub-kingdoms and full kingdoms of life that allows that life to be protected in its consciousness from the other kingdoms. It's not protected in its form. You still can get an infection from bacteria that can be very fatal. But your consciousness is not significantly affected in most cases. Now, if it kills your brain, or if you get, they're getting hallucinations because you got a really bad beastly infection, that's going to be a problem. But for most people, it's not that issue. The bigger picture, the bigger issue is that it leads to, again, consciousness controlling the system. The consciousness of plants literally is affecting the bacteria and fungi that are involved in its root system in other parts of the plant sometimes. So it's really making itself separate by having this higher consciousness, but it's using some of that consciousness to enjoy a symbiotic relationship that's working good. And plants provide an array of food that's vast. If we look at the food chain, all food really comes from some plant form. Really? Well, okay. Can you eat bacteria? I don't think you'd enjoy it too much, but yeah, you can eat bacteria. We do in cheese sometimes and other things like that, but I'm saying not, it isn't our main staple. And most people would get sick if they ate just nothing but bacteria. There's all kinds of problems. But the issue here is that, again, we find that consciousness itself creates the delineation in the kingdoms of life. It's not some form. It's actually what's going on in the form that makes the difference. So plants are different in consciousness from people. How so? Well, they're not animated. And at the same time, there is absolutely no relationship between what we would call the consciousness of human beings and the relationship of plants, because the consciousness of the two is in many respects the best way to describe it, a different phase relationship. Remember we talked about the phase issues? Well, there's a different phase relationship so that the plants are barely conscious of people. And most people are not conscious of the consciousness of plants. A few are, but very few. Plants are somewhat conscious of people, but only to a very limited extent. And we, not being conscious of plants, don't know that. So, there you go, it's a great world. Blind bliss. So the nature of consciousness is different because the way that plants get meaning is through growing mostly food and oxygen, giving off oxygen and taking in some CO2. The way humans get meaning in life is by creating from all of the lower kingdoms than themselves extensions of all of their senses, and then using those senses to develop new societies and new technologies and new ways of experiencing what we call the physical world. The most meaning, though, eventually comes. All that involves the self, the lower self. The greatest meaning eventually comes from the human saying, okay, I can do all that. Now, how do I create more meaning in life in general? Starting with human life, but also all the lower kingdoms as well. And maybe work with the higher kingdom in trying to do it. That's a big deal. That's a level of soul consciousness which we are here to try to develop. Plants aren't there. They're not doing that. They get their meaning from directly creating the sugars and some of the proteins, nucleic acids that we want. But they don't say, well, gee, we really want the humans to become more conscious and we'd like to work with them on that. They don't do that on any kind of level for plants. There are beings that are doing it, that are helping the plants. They're called group souls. And some of the devas are doing that, but most of them aren't. But some, a few. The special class of them actually do. So we've got this amazing array of differences between the consciousness within the kingdoms of life. And it's deliberately there to segregate the kingdoms so that one kingdom cannot significantly harm another kingdom by altering the consciousness of that kingdom in such a way to lower it to the point of destruction. But there is an exception. When human beings reach a state of consciousness where their consciousness can enter into another kingdom so that they can control the life in that kingdom to a substantial extent, at that point, they are not only capable of controlling the kingdom, they're responsible for it. The very existence of the kingdom on that particular planet will become dependent upon the choices made by those humans. We are at that point in terms of minerals. We're almost at that point in terms of plants. We're not near that point yet in terms of animals. But we move closer every day. And so we have great responsibilities because we have used so much of these kingdoms to take advantage, so to speak, so we can be creative, getting meaning in life, and then eventually so that we can create more of life in God's light, more of God, more virtue. And creating ourselves into more virtuous beings, we, at the same time, make those kingdoms the more beautiful. That's what we're supposed to be doing. Beauty is our design. The kingdoms usually are not beautiful when they first involve themselves. For people, we tend to make them ugly. Then we go, ooh, that's ugly. And we want to change it to become more beautiful, but we have to learn how to do that in a way that's balanced. Sometimes you say, well, the best thing to do is have everybody do these 10 things, and that will get rid of all of the ugliness. And then we find out that all it did is create another big problem that bankrupted everybody, and nobody really got any better from it. And maybe 3 or 4 new ways of destroying everything on the planet is about to happen. Because we're imbalanced. We don't understand well enough. Well, we just do these 2 things and everything will be solved. Well, it doesn't work that way. There's so much intricacy to life. You just do a little of something and you may make a big change. Trying to make giant changes on a global scale is extremely dangerous. No matter who you think you are, humility is the name of the game in that respect. Okay. So the kingdoms are divided by consciousness and not so much by form. The form side is symbiotic even between kingdoms, and within kingdoms there are form sides that are symbiotic to each other. But they're separated by consciousness. Because consciousness is where the meaning of life exists for them, and that part they can't completely share because they're individuals, and the meaning of life is related to the consciousness of life, and the two together develops the individuality of the self, and that's unique. So you interfere with individuality if you start contaminating kingdoms, and especially if you start demanding or restricting the freedom of a kingdom. I don't care if it's taking plants and putting them in a small bucket where they need to have a giant yard to grow in, or if you take people and put them in a country with no freedom. That restricts them from almost all activities that are meaningful to them. They all are, at the bottom line in the situation, a way of destroying consciousness and meaning. And they're parts of what evil does. Evil is looking to do that. You hear me talk about this all the time, I just don't put it in these words. But that's what I say when some, you know, part of our government here in the United States or elsewhere in the world is doing something to remove freedom from people, remove choices, even remove, strangely, group responsibility for wise giving and replace it with a thing called social justice, which is insanity, because that lowers consciousness. But the process is such that we are here to make the mistakes and suffer in loss of consciousness, because that's what suffering is, so that we will consciously choose to be more conscious. Let me say that again. In ultimate terms, the human is here to come to the conclusion and to create in ways that maximizes their consciousness. And that joins with their awareness of God that they have from through two senses that are conscious that other creatures don't have below human. And when coupled with that factor, we are the first of all conscious beings to not only recognize our own creator, but to want to co-create with that creator more consciousness in everything else around us, and further to not interfere in that development. Not interfere. Because we have to be careful. The kingdoms are there for a reason. If we interfere in the kingdoms, we have to make sure the consciousness and meaning for the life of that kingdom is going up and not down. Let me give you an example. Is it right or wrong to eat animals? Well, let me put it like this. Do you think that eating an animal that you grow to slay, you take care of to eat, and you manage and breed to have all of its different parts used in some instrument or cloth or some other thing that you want? You think that helps to raise the consciousness of those animals? Or is it likely that by doing those things, we lower our own consciousness while we interfere with the development of consciousness in the animals that we subject to this treatment? You say, well, what am I going to eat? I like hamburgers. Well, we're at the point now where there are lots of foods that you can eat besides meat. Or at least when I say meat, I'm talking about anything that ever had consciousness. You interfere with the development of something when you interfere with its consciousness, not when you interfere with its form. So, in theory, you could shave the wool off of sheep. If the sheep continues to develop in consciousness, but that requires the sheep have maybe unusual levels of an environment that you supply for it so that life is still meaningful for it. Not that it's penned up all the time. You're starting to get the idea here. Further, the sheep should be allowed to have free choice about much of what it does, maybe even if it wants to be sheared or not. You say, well, how many sheep are going to want to be sheared? That's a good question. Could we develop a relationship with sheep where symbiotically, like the bacteria come to the tree or a plant, the sheep come to us to be shaved? And maybe it's a little too warm for them otherwise. We provide them with shelter, and the shelter is warm, and they prefer to be shaved. we give them the ability to learn that and to voluntarily say, hey, I'm ready for a haircut if you don't mind. It's not impossible. As a matter of fact, it's even the better alternative. Now, you know, you may not be eating any lamb chops. Eventually, some sheep will die, but I don't, still don't suggest you eat the meat of sheep. But the result is that you're not breeding for that purpose, and the consciousness that is within them is not being lowered, so that when you eat the meat that they have, it further lowers you. Oh, you say, well, how does the consciousness travel with the meat? Well, remember that energy thing I told you about? The reason we eat food is because it has two constituents to it. It has energies in the form of sugars and fats, and it has proteins. It may also have fiber and other things that help structurally with our body, but those are the big deals. Now, energy is affected by consciousness. We already know that. We're taking in energy, calories, and that energy could be dark energy or it could be enlightened energy. If it's dark energy because it's animals that have been slaughtered, then our options are going to be, well, the more we eat that, the lower our consciousness grows. Wow, that's cool. And then you've got something else going on. When we make the choice that, unfortunately, a lot of people make, to ignore the plight of the kingdom that we're interfering in, we are becoming tone deaf to God, the light we can do in us. So even if we don't eat the meat, we torture the animals. And believe me, it is torture to raise something to be slaughtered. Worse than that, just look at how they breed pigs, chickens, or whatever else. They're highly mistreated, aren't they? Barely any meaning in their existence, if you could imagine it. Some amoeba have more meaning in their life than some chickens do. All right, so we have a situation now where that becomes a center focus. Not only is it the energy and the proteins and the food, etc., the behaviors dehumanize the human. We lose the senses in our heart and crown chakras or centers, and our sense of God is diminished. Just eating the meat causes it, but even worse, the raising of the meat, the raising of the poor creatures. Does it? Oh, well, you don't grow any animals, you just go down to the supermarket. Actually, for children, that might be a way for them to say they don't really understand what the problem is. But not for us, not for adults. Come on. We know better. We just turn our heads. No, don't see it. Don't know about it. Ever watch anybody watching the mistreatment of livestock? He wins. They can't take it. Most people. Now, if it's someone who raises the livestock, they're used to it, they may not. That's a bad sign. Not a good one. But why do the majority of people who don't do that wince? Why do they have a hard time with it? What is the problem? It's against their soul. It's against their consciousness. Just to watch it lowers their consciousness. They suffer as they see it. They can't stand it. Most people. Oh, you don't believe me? Well, get some movies with that in it. Slaughterhouses. Go to visit one. See how you feel. See where your consciousness is. Okay. So, again, we see this element being so critical and important. So, we have a lot of options. We don't even know all the ways that animals can be of value to us because we eat them, and we grow them to eat them, which is worse than just eating them. It would be better if we only killed those that were free all the time, watch as, say, some American Indians did and others. The problem is it's not a very efficient lifestyle, and it's very difficult for people to become proficient at it, and it could take most of your day hunting for food. And so it's not practical. What is practical is to develop synthetic meats as well as to use plant sources. And believe it or not, milk and cheese and eggs, if the eggs are never fertilized, never has consciousness in it. It comes from animals. And if those animals are well treated, there's no reason to not eat that food. That food will help your body to grow, because you're helping animals to grow more conscious. It's okay to get a few chickens and get some eggs, but treat the chickens like pets. Don't treat them like cooped up, literally, birds in a little box where they barely know if it's night or day except for a light bulb. Don't do that. Chickens are pretty smart, by the way. And their smartness is a combination of both consciousness along with pretty darn good senses. And because they are giving us food, the female chicken, the hen, is actually more prone to being conscious than the rooster in some circumstances. Everybody says, well, males are usually more intelligent. Well, the rooster is only more intelligent in terms of protecting the hen and possessing the hen and mating with the hen. It's that more conscious on a general way of being able to relate to human beings. Ever try to relate to a rooster? Compare that to relating to a hen. You'll see what I'm talking about. So the bottom line here is that we really have an interesting thing. There's examples everywhere we turn, in every kingdom we deal with, of the concepts that I have presented in tonight's show. It's right there. You can't miss it. Or can you? Okay, very quickly, I'm going to go, don't have much time, I'm going to go ahead and give you some ideas of consciousness beyond the human kingdom. We've dealt with these kingdoms as much as I can in tonight's show. But the kingdoms beyond human are no longer concerned with trying to overcome illusion and selfishness in the three worlds that human beings live in. They actually have a sense of consciousness, which is God. They have a sense of God, which is like one sense of life, in all three of the worlds that human beings live in, and the higher mental world where the human soul exists. The members of the next kingdom incorporate all of that as a sense within themselves, which is extremely sensitive and aware beyond anything that we can do. And it can, in each one of these different times and relationship times and spaces of time and space, they can sense at the same time. So they don't live in a single dimension. They live at a minimum of at least three whole dimensions and part of a dimension called the Buddha. At least half or better of the Buddha dimension is incorporated within their consciousness. Now, what does it mean to have the dimension in their consciousness? It means that the virtue of God, which is beauty, by the way, has become embedded in them through many lifetimes of being human, if they are coming from the human class of life, or if they are a solar angel, they serve humans as a alter ego soul for the human soul. And so, in either way, it doesn't matter. The human is a key element here. And we become them through our own initiative and creation, except for on Earth, there is a small initiative made by the next kingdom to both the solar angel or energy part and the super being part together, they provide a small bump in us changing from human to superhuman. This is called initiation process. Most planets don't use it. It's clumsy. It produces imbalances in human development. And the human beings that go through the process, as they're going through it, become too disconnected from the rest of humanity. They don't understand them. They don't see them right. And there's conflict and other issues. So basically, it's not the greatest thing, but it does one thing: it accelerates the growth of consciousness. And since that's what it's all about, when given the choice and the necessity, because of time issues, to grow human life faster and to get it into the superhuman kingdom as fast as possible, initiation is chosen on rare planets. Most of the time, they go slow. But if you got to rush, hey, got to do what you got to do. All right. And we're in a rush. The superhuman condition is a state that human beings don't really understand. It's the state of ultimate sacrifice of the things that we consider to be important to many human beings, while enjoying the state of bliss. Now, what is bliss? Bliss is the sensation of creation on a mass scale, while one is never focused on one's self development. Whoa, what? Yeah. So human beings are almost always concerned about themselves, their little self, and when they become members of the next kingdom, they give up that. They no longer can do it. And that's how they get there. They get from the human kingdom to the superhuman kingdom by giving up their concern for themselves. I'm not just talking about a little thing, like, oh, well, here, you can have my seat on the bus. No. You can have all the seats that I have anything to do with. You can have everything I have, provided it's the wisest way for you to grow in consciousness. You live for others so that they can grow and do the same. And you don't give to others who won't do that, because that would be harmful to the common good of all. Sort of social justice upside down and correct, finally. It is an amazing system because it's based upon souls. We call the souls that reach this level liberated souls. What are they liberated from? They're liberated from illusion. The illusion is of the three lower worlds. It's not that souls have done terrible things the way humans, an entity they create from themselves, have done. They have illusion because they have a lack of consciousness in the three lower worlds. And they have to develop it by creating a part of themselves that goes and has all these terrible experiences and makes so many mistakes. And it is very selfish. But they do that because they have to gain consciousness in it. They have to. Or they can't move on. They will forever, would be forever, an imprisoned soul in the higher mental world and not be able to be liberated. Liberation is extreme levels of increased meaning from increased consciousness with no focus on what we would call themselves or their lower self. They function from a higher self position, and meaning comes from creation of virtue or light in the world. That's what they do. They spend all their time doing it once they're liberated. Therefore, i.e., a master of the age of wisdom, or if you're in the energy kingdom, a solar angel. That state is the goal for human beings via their souls. Human beings are only a trip a piece of the soul goes on. And when we die from the lower mental world, we are full consciousness of our human soul. Some of us gain it in full consciousness. Some of us can't garner that, but it's like we go to sleep and then awaken again to the soul. But it's still us, except us and this much bigger being are one and the same. It's like, oh, gee, not only could I have had a V8, but I could have had a much better life, because here I am. I'm this great being. I just didn't function that way when I was in so much illusion due to the high density of energy, the lack of ability to make changes very easily, and the tremendous amount of forces that I encountered. I became selfish, self-centered, lacked humility, lacked good judgment, was unwise in the giving I did. And when I did give wisely, I didn't give it up. Those are the kinds of things that happen. The soul doesn't have regrets about it. It has understanding, and it benefits from it. It doesn't have regrets because it doesn't actually experience the suffering. It never lost the consciousness, just the human did. And the human suffered and pays for the suffering itself, not the soul. But the human is eventually joined in consciousness with that soul and then liberated from the mental world into the buddhic, into the intuitional plane, where they live a life of bliss and beyond bliss of creation of God in ways that is, at this point, almost inconceivable. I could tell you a couple of things, but it would probably not make much sense. Imagine this. You can grow a pot of flowers, and you do so by tending it with water and vitamins and fertilizers and give it sunlight and right temperature and all these things. That's a human being. Human beings do that sometimes, and it's wonderful. The flowers prosper, and they grow a certain way. We decide what seeds to put where and how they arrange it. It's beautiful, we think it's beautiful. To a master, that would not necessarily be an interest. Instead, the master helps thousands of varieties of flowers to grow more beautiful by changes, slight changes in some circumstances, into the structure of their, what we would call DNA, but and helping devonic energies and their group soul to learn how to grow themselves everywhere, and preferably not in a flower pot, so the entire world becomes beautified by some uniquely new flowers who also, maybe 100,000 years in the future, but can maybe occasionally get up, deroot themselves, and move over a little bit. Or maybe they can move their leaves a little bit to shade something. Or maybe they give off some light at night. It'd be kind of nice to have the flowers and plants lighting things up, don't you think? That's coming. Definitely. We may see that, depending upon how old you are. If you're younger than about 20, 25 years old, I think you will see that, if you live a normal life. Okay, so that's what's coming. Will human beings create that? Sort of, not really. It's going to come from higher sources. We'll notice it, and then we'll say, oh, if we do these five things, we can make it happen. We may cooperate with it. That's very important. It's actually started by beings higher than we are. The whole concept is terrible. Anyway, I'm out of time. Oh, boy, I'd love to talk about this so much more, especially about the higher kingdom, since I barely touched on it, and that I just started with, you know, liberated soul. That's the beginning of a journey so far that it's all the way to beyond our imagination. And every step of the way, consciousness is growing and meaning in life is getting greater. It just keeps going and going and going. And there's never an end. Okay, well, we're out of time for now. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.